We'll hear arguments now in number 86-6169, William Wayne Thompson versus Oklahoma. Mr. Tepper, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. In this case, Oklahoma has decided that a 15-year-old boy lost his moral entitlement to live because he committed a brutal murder, the killing of the ex-husband of his sister. According to prosecution evidence, the motive for this murder was revenge. Revenge for the ex-husband's abuse of the boy's sister. This case comes before this court on certiorari to the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals. Petitioner asked this court to vacate the sentence of death, but not the judgment that Wayne Thompson was guilty and not the judgment that he deserves punishment. Two basic issues in this case relate to one fundamental principle. The principle that youth bears on the fundamental justice of the death penalty, and emotion and prejudice do not. First, does this principle require a minimum chronological age, or at least standards and instructions that tell the sentencing authority that their examination of non-adulthood should not be truncated? Second, did introduction of inflammatory photographs of the murder victim's decomposing remains undermine the reliability of this death sentencing process? Wayne Thompson was still a child under state law when he shot and killed the ex-husband of his sister. According to the prosecution's most incriminating evidence, the boy, on the night of the murder, shortly after the crime, confessed to his mother and explained to her that his sister would not have to worry about her ex-husband anymore. Wayne was certified to stand trial as if he were an adult. The jury was told that he was an adult. The jury was instructed that youth is a relevant mitigating circumstance they could consider, but they were not told that youth is a relevant mitigating circumstance of great weight. They were told that they could decide for themselves what were and were not mitigating circumstances. These are the instructions before the jury sentenced Wayne to death. Under these circumstances, in a very real sense, this case comes before the court, presenting this court with the first opportunity to decide whether or not Wayne Thompson was too young to be condemned to death. We submit under the circumstances of this case, as well as under circumstances generally applicable to a class of children and adolescents, it is most inappropriate, under the Eighth Amendment, under the prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment, to inflict the death sentence.
How old is he now?
He is 20 now, Your Honor.
Sir?
He is 20 now, Your Honor. The reasons for treating youth in a special manner have been recognized by this court on a number of occasions. We submit that these factors, these reasons for treating youth in a special way, are compelling in this particular circumstance. First, children and adolescents are simply too inexperienced to be judged by the same standards applicable to adults. They haven't been around long enough to formulate the understanding, the capacity for self-control, to be judged by standards according to adults. The question is not merely whether they know the difference between right or wrong, it's whether they have the experience to be able to apply those standards, to resist the stress, the trauma, the difficulties of particularly difficult occasions. We submit that, in addition to that, it's quite plain that children, adolescents, are far more vulnerable to volatile, impulsive, self-destructive behavior. And this, recognized by this court in the past, is grounds for treating youths in a different manner, particularly when the punishment is death.
Mr. Tepker, do you think that it would be a violation of the Eighth Amendment to execute a minor who has, for example, reached the age of 17 years and 9 months at the time the offense is committed, and who is found in an individual determination to have the moral culpability of an adult?
Your Honor, we argue for a minimum chronological age.
Yes, I know you do, but my question is, do you think that it is a per se violation of the Eighth Amendment under the circumstances I describe.
Yes, we do, Your Honor. We contend that 18 is the most dominant traditional definition of non-adulthood. And in this situation, when you're short of 18, the chances that, excuse me.
In the abortion context, this court has held that a minor can and must be treated as an adult upon proving her individual maturity to be so treated. And yet you say in this context, we may not do that, and the Constitution says we may not. That's a little bit inconsistent, perhaps.
I think not, Your Honor. I think there is a difference between defining the reality and significance of adulthood for and non-adulthood for purposes of inflicting the death sentence and making that same calculation when what is at stake is the fundamental right of privacy. That balancing, that inquiry is not the same. And I do not suggest that Bellotti versus Baird or other cases which recognize the difficulties here block this particular case. I must insist that the question you pose is not the question before this court in one sense. Wayne Thompson was not certified to stand trial as an adult because he had a maturity beyond his years.
Well, did the petitioner challenge the certification process in this case, either at the trial or appellate court level?
He did challenge it at the appellate court level, Your Honor, and his appeal was
on the grounds that it was constitutionally insufficient or inadequate?
On Kent versus United States grounds, yes, but we are not relying upon those at this point. That time has passed. The question really here is whether the certification process negates the need for some focused attention on non-adulthood in relation to the death penalty. Certification proceeding is not geared toward that.
Did the petitioner ask the trial court to instruct the jury to consider age as a mitigating factor?
He did not, Your Honor. Well, excuse me. He did ask for an instruction that youth was cited by the defense as a mitigating factor. But the more particular instructions that we suggested in our brief were not requested by trial counsel. We submit, however, trial counsel did present the issue of youth. Appellate counsel did argue the per se issue, and we submit it would be most unusual if this court took away from itself the opportunity to decide the issue on narrower grounds. And that's why, and in my response to your initial question, trying to suggest that 18 years of age is the appropriate generalization line for defining the significance of non-adulthood versus adulthood.
Is that your definite submission here, a bright line at age 18?
That's the one that seems most logical to us based upon tradition, but we do suggest.
Of course, 16 would save Mr. Thompson anyway, wouldn't it?
It would indeed, Your Honor. And if this court took the position that it wanted a greater consensus and it wanted to establish a floor that was truly a minimal floor, the fact that no state, having decided to select an express limitation on the death penalty, has selected an age below 16, might make 16 indeed the most logical line for purposes of federal constitutional law. We have attempted to provide the range of alternatives that would be necessary to resolve this case.
Mr. Tepper, are there some states other than Oklahoma in which a minor below the age of 16 could be sentenced to death?
There are indeed, Your Honor. But 60% of the jurisdictions in this country, encompassing 70% of the population, would not tolerate this execution.
That is 60% of the jurisdictions which provide for capital punishment?
No, that's 60% of the states total. It's approximately half of the states that retain the death penalty establish minimum lines that would not allow this execution.
And half of them don't?
That's right.
Half of them would allow it?
Half of them allow the potential for it. Although I might add that if one takes into account the more general question about whether youth bears upon the fundamental justice of the death penalty, Oklahoma is one of only three states that has neither a minimum line nor any special legislative declaration that youth is a mitigating circumstance. And it's only the only one of those three states to have someone on death row who's a juvenile.
But didn't the trial judge say that the jury could take youth into consideration as a mitigating circumstance here?
He did, Your Honor, but then he said, what is a mitigating circumstance is up for you to decide. We submit that that violates the spirit of Eddings versus Oklahoma, in which this court said youth is a relevant mitigating circumstance of great weight, and it violates the principle which was stated in a concurring opinion in Skipper, which you joined, which says youth bears directly on the fundamental justice of the death penalty. The instructions left the jury with the impression that they had complete discretion over the matter. Moreover, the jury was told, contrary to the legal facts, that he was an adult. When they asked that question of the trial judge, the trial judge responded, yes, he's an adult. He was a child under the laws of Oklahoma.
So you say that the jury should have been instructed that youth is a mitigating factor and you should take it into consideration in your deliberations?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And it should have been correctly informed as to his status under Oklahoma law, that he was a child under the laws of Oklahoma. For all of these reasons, we submit there is great risk in this case, apparent from the record, that the jury's inquiry into youth, into non-adulthood, was truncated. It was truncated by the failure to answer the jury more specifically when they asked about the meaning of the word mitigating. It was truncated when the jury was told he was an adult. It was truncated when they were not told in specific, particularized ways that youth is at the heart of this case and that they must make a judgment
about
that.
Well, did the petitioner object when the trial court told the jury that he had been certified as an adult?
No, he did not, Your Honor.
And did he raise the point in the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals?
On the issue of adulthood, no. But the Oklahoma appellate public defender did raise the issue that more particularized guidelines focusing the jury on the mitigating circumstances was necessary. And I might add, that would have required an overruling of an explicit Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals decision, Cheney versus State, in which particularized guidelines are not allowed under Oklahoma law. We submit that this process made it very clear that there's a constitutionally unacceptable risk that non-adulthood was not weighed in a sensitive, careful, reasoned way in this particular case. We also submit that this case also has additional facts which make this inappropriate occasion for infliction of the death sentence. According to the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals, inflammatory photographs of decomposing remains of the murder victim were introduced and used by the prosecutor in closing argument during the death sentencing process.
Was the effect of those photographs raised below?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. The
On the sentencing phase?
There is an ambiguity in the record on that point, Your Honor. The appellate public defender argued strenuously that it was erroneous to admit the photographs. The argument of the appellate public defender did not distinguish between the sentencing phase and the guilt phase, but it was not focused solely on the guilt phase. The appellate public defender also criticized the trial prosecutor for his use of the photographs in closing argument, also in connection with mischaracterizing the defendant's age.
Do you think there's any constitutional difficulty, Mr. Tucker, in introducing a photograph that shows the brutality of a killing, if in fact the killing was brutal? I mean, if there's 6 or 8 wounds on the body, do you think there's some reason why a photograph simply showing those wounds couldn't be introduced?
Perhaps, Your Honor, although I would...
What is the source of your reservation?
Well, I recognize it's an extremely difficult task to ask this court to get into the business, difficult and unpleasant, of what photographs are too gruesome and what photographs are not. Here, the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals found the photographs to be ghastly, gruesome, calculated only to inflame the jury, and proving virtually nothing. And in another case,
because of their submersion for almost a month. Hmm?
That's right. I mean, the photographs depicted the biology of decomposition, not the brutality of the crime.
Well, but how, if the prosecutor had some other photographs that didn't show the decomposition but showed the brutality, that would be one thing. But my impression is here there was no choice.
If the photographs were probative of the way in which the crime was committed, probative and relevant for those grounds, then I would think that'd be an entirely different case, Your Honor, one that would bear upon the fundamental justice of the death penalty because of the aggravating circumstance of what is cruel, atrocious, and heinous. But that's not the situation here. The Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals said these photographs proved virtually nothing.
No, but they said that in saying they were not relevant to the determination of guilt.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
We don't really know whether they thought they're relevant to the determination of the appropriate death sentence, appropriate penalty. There's nothing in their opinion that tells us whether they thought they could appropriately be considered in connection with sentencing.
Well, Your Honor, I would suggest this. The Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals denounced the introduction of these photographs in very strong terms and then said they were harmless as to guilt or innocence. It gave no indication whatsoever that these photographs could have been admissible during the sentencing phase.
It gave no indication one way or the other on admissibility at the sentencing hearing. That's all I'm saying.
That's a fair characterization, Your Honor. We submit, however, that because of the way in which the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals described these photographs, the facts that they found in relation to the inflammatory nature of these photographs, the constitutionally unacceptable risk that the jury was distracted from its duty, distracted from the true assessment of what is an appropriate death sentence, is plain and apparent on the record. If I may return to the basic, what we've tried to describe in our arguments is the narrow Eighth Amendment arguments. It is very clear that almost all jurisdictions, some 94% of the jurisdictions, either have a minimum line or have something in their legislation which clearly indicates that cases involving youthful offenders are special. They deserve to be treated differently. That degree of consensus, along with the other factors surrounding the judgment of the young in a capital sentencing case, make it particularly appropriate for this court to declare now, to reaffirm, that youth bears on the fundamental justice of the death penalty.
Well, that's not what we're asked to do. I mean, that doesn't win you your case. It seems to me the relevant statistic would be what percentage of the states have a line that would have rendered this conviction and this sentence inappropriate.
Your Honor,
what percentage is that?
60% of the jurisdictions encompassing 70% of the population with an absolute line.
What jurisdictions that have criminal, that have capital punishment? It's, of course, irrelevant with respect to those jurisdictions that have chosen not to impose capital punishment at all. But as to those that have, you say about half of them would not have allowed this sentence.
That's true. The percentage is half. Although I must suggest that when we're considering the nature of the death penalty and considering the judgment of the young, to throw out those states that have decided the death penalty process is uncertain enough or illogical enough or perhaps too cruel, out of the calculation of what are evolving standards of decency, is to not inquire into what the consensus really is.
We have no idea what they would think about youth as a factor had they chosen capital punishment. They simply haven't chosen capital punishment. We have no idea. They haven't chosen it for adults or for youthful offenders. So it really says nothing about whether, if they did have it, they would consider that youth is a factor that would render it absolutely intolerable.
Well, let me shift then to try and suggest this. This court has used international opinion and international law in order to assess what our society's evolving standards of decency.
We wouldn't have capital punishment at all if we were to be bound by that, would we?
Well, I'm not certain about that, Your Honor, and I'm not attempting to challenge or restrict the death penalty generally here at all. What I'm suggesting is that 80 nations reject this kind of execution, and 40 of those nations retain the death penalty. If you add to that the practice of the nations in terms of the rarity of these kinds of executions, the clear statements that appear in the International Covenant of Human Rights and the American Convention of Human Rights, it becomes very clear that there is an objective rejection of execution of children. And Wayne Thompson was a child under the laws of Oklahoma.
Does the federal government place any limitation upon age with regard to the statutes in which it allows capital punishment to be imposed? About the federal jurisdiction.
I'm unaware of a federal death penalty that goes to the question.
It goes to the question?
Yes. I guess I'm unaware of the answer your question. I did not think that there was authorization on the part of the federal government for a death sentence of juveniles.
Oh, none of juveniles, but there is a death penalty in the federal code. Is there any limitation upon the imposition of that upon juveniles?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
You don't know that there is?
I don't know that there is. The reasons for this great consensus, and I must suggest strenuously it is a very strong consensus, really reflect the fact that it is so terribly difficult to make judgments about anybody at this tender age. As I suggested before, there is an inexperience factor here. There's also the sense in which these people at this age have not been in command of their own lives. They haven't taken responsibility for establishing a place in the community separate from family, from friends, and from parents. For all of these reasons, generally, it is extremely difficult to make a judgment about a child or adolescent.
Do you have any statistics which could tell us how many juveniles have been prosecuted for offenses carrying the death penalty?
Prosecuted for offenses carrying the death penalty. I believe not, Your Honor. We do have in our brief the fact that those who receive the death penalty in proportion to the number who are arrested for criminal homicide are much, much smaller. It's something like 0.06% as opposed to 1.8%.
But we don't know actually how many are under age 18, for example, of those now on death row were prosecuted for offenses carrying the death penalty when they were committed it when they were under 18. You don't have that.
Percentages, no. There are approximately 32 individuals on death row. And if I understand Your Honor's question, about filing charges, I don't have information about filing charges.
What I'm trying to get at is how many have been prosecuted for offenses carrying the death penalty, and how many of those prosecuted, in fact, were given the death penalty.
That's an extremely difficult statistic to come up with. The best we have in our brief is the difference in proportion, the differential proportion based upon arrests for criminal homicide. And, of course, that presents a problem about which arrests for criminal homicide are, in fact, capital offenses. With respect to the uncertainty of the judgment, I would like to draw attention to the amicus brief, for the American Society of Adolescent Psychiatry, which eloquently summarizes the evidence that what is happening with respect to the juvenile death sentence is not a situation where these individuals are being sentenced based upon a judgment that they have a maturity beyond their years. They're being sentenced to death despite their evident immaturity and retarded development. The fact is that the American Psychiatric Association, when it discusses the diagnosis of antisocial personality, states very clearly that such a diagnosis should not be made until someone has had the time, the experience, to show the full longitudinal pattern. It is only then when an individual is, in a sense, ready for the kind of judgment. The fact is that these individuals, this class of juveniles and adolescents, share characteristics universally regarded as mitigating, as deserving less punishment, or at least a more generous judgment in the final analysis. They share characteristics which make a judgment that they should be held responsible to the superlative degree cruel and unusual. We submit that in this case, tradition yields a principle of decent restraint that the judgment and the punishment of the young should be more careful and sensitive. The only way to ensure that this tradition is vindicated is through a rule that leaves no latitude for evasion, a minimum chronological age. But short of that, Short of that, we suggest that when a state seeks to kill a human being for the crimes of childhood or adolescence, it must show at a minimum that it made a reasoned, careful judgment based upon the reality of non-adulthood, without the influence of emotion or prejudice. For these reasons, we pray that this court vacate the sentence of death in this case and remand to Oklahoma. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tepker. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, in my view, this case involves two questions. Whether it was cruel and unusual punishment to impose the death sentence upon the petitioner in this case, and whether this Court should set, as an aspect of the United States Constitution, a minimum chronological age under which no state could go in imposing the death sentence, regardless of the circumstances of the individual crime and irrespective of the individual defendant's maturity and background in each individual case. In the present case, the petitioner murdered the victim 1.5 months prior to the petitioner's 16th birthday. The petitioner had 9 contacts with law enforcement officers, 7 of which occurred prior to the murder in this case. 4 of those incidents involved assaults on persons, and 2 of those involved assault with a deadly weapon. Testimony at trial revealed that the petitioner announced to witnesses as he left his house on the night of the murder, "We're going to kill Charles." The victim died after having been brutally beaten, having his throat cut, and having been shot in the back of the head. After the murder, the petitioner told witnesses on 2 different occasions that he had cut the victim's throat and shot him in the head. The petitioner made other several callous comments after the murder that revealed that he felt no remorse, a fact that was corroborated by testimony by the psychologist who examined him and by his juvenile officer. Concerning the question of the petitioner's age, the state contends that the adoption of the petitioner's argument that this court should set a minimum chronological age would require this court to engage in artificial and arbitrary line drawing with regard to the decision whether to impose the death sentence upon a young murderer. In its decisions over the past 11 years, this court has stressed the need for individualized decisions regarding the death sentence. We contend also that there is no reason why age should be given any greater consideration or any greater weight than other mitigating circumstances, such as those involving mental retardation or mental illness. Furthermore, a significant class of violent criminals in this country should not automatically be immunized from the possibility of receiving the death sentence. It is unquestioned, as this Court itself recognized in the Eddings case, that young criminals increasingly engage in violent crime, and to announce in advance that none of them, under any set of circumstances, could receive the death sentence regardless of the maturity that they displayed or the viciousness of the crime that they commit, would be, in our view, to send the wrong message.
I didn't hear the last part. Would be, in your view, what?
That to announce in advance that under no circumstances, regardless of the maturity that an individual defendant displayed, are irrespective of the viciousness of the crime that defendant committed, we feel like would send a wrong message to other potential young murderers in this country.
Then you would say the same thing to those states which do not have the death penalty for adults.
Well, we think that the individual states should be allowed the discretion whether to impose the death penalty or not.
I'm merely saying that your argument would apply to states without the death penalty equally.
Well, of course, those states have the right to choose whether or not they want to impose the death penalty on a person of any age. And we think that if a state chooses to announce to the potential killers in that state that in appropriate circumstances, if they commit a particularly vicious act, that they, too, are subject to the death penalty.
What about, suppose Thompson had been 10 years old, what would be your position then?
Justice Stevens asked that question of me in the Eddings case in 1981, and I told him at that time that, in my view, it would be a violation of the Eighth Amendment to to impose the death penalty on an individual that was 10 years of age.
It would be.
Yes, we concede that it would. That would obviously be too young.
What about 12?
And you we don't
what I'm
think
going to
that
do. I'm going up the ladder.
Yes.
Where would you draw the line?
We don't think that this court should decide in advance what that minimum age should be. We think this court should merely look at the facts of this individual case and review what Oklahoma has done in this individual case. Right now, there are no people on death row in America, and haven't been, who are under the age of 15 years old at the time of the commission of the crime. So we
would say that any 10-year-old, no matter where he is, may not be executed.
I think that there would be common and unanimous agreement among all people that that would be too young for an individual to receive the death penalty. However, we think the country is divided with regard to the minimum age of imposing the death sentence.
Mr. Lee, when is the last time that a state in this country has executed someone who was under 16 at the time of the commission of the murder?
In 1948, there was an execution of an individual who was 16 years of age.
And executed anyone?
No, Your Honor. We have never executed anybody under the age of 18 at the time of the commission of the crime. But we think that we should be able to, in view of changing conditions, make the decision in an appropriate case. I'm glad to say that we don't have a lot of young people on death row in our state. And nationwide, I am glad that that's not the case. But we think that individual states, if they've made a careful, individualized consideration as to an individual's maturity and background, that they should be allowed to impose the death penalty in this case. This is an individual. Mr. Tepker has talked about the fact that young people are impulsive or immature. That is not the case in this particular in Mr. Thompson's case. He had a number of previous contacts with law enforcement officials. He knew what he was doing would get him into trouble. The particular act in this particular case was not an impulsive act. We agree that young people may be generally impulsive, but the fact is that this individual defendant did not commit an impulsive act. It was a considered act. The fact that he had a motive to kill his ex-brother-in-law shows even more that it was calculated and planned, and it was certainly not an impulsive act.
Mr. Lee, may I ask you, when you conceded that the execution of a 10-year-old for murder would be unconstitutional, were you resting that on a violation of the cruel and unusual punishment clause of the Eighth Amendment?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that would violate anybody's sense of decency under the Eighth Amendment.
So there's nothing in the Eighth Amendment which suggests such an exception, is there?
Well, obviously, this court is going to be the arbiter as what do constitute a situation, what does constitute a situation that would violate the consensus of the public in this country that an execution of a person at a particularly young age would be unconstitutional. But we think that the fact that there are 19 states in this country that allow the execution of an individual under the age of 16. I think you ask people generally, and they're divided, particularly if you show them the individual facts of individual murder cases. For example, the case that this court heard last term, the Christopher Berger case. You ask general public opinion about what should be done with that individual, and I think that there would be a lot of people in this country that would agree that he should be executed. This particular case involves, I think, also a very serious crime. Although the victim in this case was not a particularly appealing person, he underwent a very horrible murder. He had the pathologist testified that all of the wounds that he had inflicted upon him were inflicted while he was still alive up until the time that he was shot in the back of the head. So I think that this particular case, particularly in view of the fact that this individual had previous contact with law enforcement officials, I don't think that this particular case involves a violation of the Eighth Amendment. We also contend that a rule of constitutional law that would set a minimum chronological age for the imposition of the death penalty would make no allowance for any increase in the...
But you've accepted that, I thought. You've accepted that.
Well, not at the age 15.
All right. Well, but that's all we're arguing about then.
Well, he's
asking what age it should be set at.
Well, he's asking for 18. And
I understand,
I'm saying,
but then don't argue to us why a rule of constitutional law establishing a chronological age is bad, because you've accepted a rule of constitutional law that uses a chronological age, haven't you?
Well, I'm saying this Court doesn't have to say what that minimum chronological age would be. I'm saying that there's nobody on death row in America that's under the age of 15. There are four that are now. There, since 1984, there have been six that are. But I'm saying this Court does not have to say in advance, in the absence of the – excuse me.
We don't have to say it in this case.
Yes, or at any time. I don't see – I mean, like I said, there has been nobody who's been 14 or under who has received the death penalty in this country in recent years. And I'm just asking the Court to make an individualized consideration of this case, as it insisted the states do in other death penalty cases.
You say, Mr. Lee, that there have been four or six in recent years that received the death penalty under 15?
Since 1984, according to my calculations, there have been six individuals under the age of 16.
Who were sentenced to death?
Yes, they were all 15 years of age.
How many of those were carried out?
There have been none carried out, and at the present time, there are three that are presently, of those 15, there are three that are presently on death row. Mr. Thompson, an individual in Indiana, and another individual in North Carolina.
But none has been carried out?
No, Your Honor.
Any significance to that, do you think?
Well, there has been a problem nationally with imposing the death penalty on people of any age. There have been only approximately 95 executions in this country since 1967, although there are 2,000 people on death row. And obviously, juries and sentencers and appellate judges in this country are going to be careful with regard to the death penalty being imposed on a young person. We certainly welcome that, and we think that the certification hearing conducted by Oklahoma in this case revealed that there was a careful consideration and individual judgment with regard to this individual defendant's maturity and responsibility. We think that it's important that in 1971, Congress, in hearings involving the 26th Amendment, adopted the testimony of Dr. Margaret Mead and others who testified that the age of maturity had declined 3 years since the 18th century. And it's also significant, I think, as we pointed out in our brief, that in 1984, Congress lowered the age for possible transfer in federal criminal prosecutions from 16 to 15 years of age.
In 1985, Congress insisted that the states raise the drinking age, didn't it?
Yes, and that's 21. But I don't think that anybody would say that 21 should be the bright line. The fact is that chronological age is an inherently poor criterion for making a decision whether or not somebody should have the death penalty imposed upon them.
Mr. Lee, does this come down to the fact that you recognize that the Eighth Amendment would allow you to enforce the 15-year limit, but we can't put the 18-year limit?
I think it would
is
be.
Is that your point?
I'm sorry, Justice Marshall, I didn't hear the first part of your question.
That you can set the 15-year limit, but this Court cannot set the 18-year limit.
Well, I don't think that 15 should necessarily be the limit. I'm saying that 15 years is the lowest person that we have on death row in this country.
Well, I thought you said you agreed that it could be done at 15.
No, I'm saying that...
Didn't you say that?
No, Your Honor. If I said it...
You didn't say that you could understand that 15 years was a good time.
No, I did not say that 15 should be the minimum age.
What did you say?
Justice Blackmun asked me if 12 should be the minimum age, I think was the last age that he asked me, and I said that at that point I said I don't think this Court needs to decide in advance what the minimum age would be.
What minimum would you use?
If I had to pick?
Yes, sir.
If there is any bright line, and I've thought about this for 6 years since Eddings, and of course I thought about it before Eddings, if I had to pick a particular bright line, if there was a case directly before this Court, if there's any bright line, the age 14 is the age of common law incapacity. And this Court, in two previous cases, the Galt case and the Ford case, which you yourself wrote, Justice Marshall, used the common law as a guideline in that particular case, for the imposition of the death penalty upon somebody who was insane. Blackstone, in commentaries on this page 23, which we have cited in our brief, pointed out that from 7 to 14 is the common law age of presumed incapacity.
I would say that our educational system and our government and everything else has sure progressed from Blackstone.
Well,
hasn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, but you're asking for to me to tell the court what the bright line is, and the court used Blackstone when it pointed out
that why we can't do it. Why we can't set a use bright line at 18.
I think it's unnecessary for the court to do so, particularly in this case. I think that the court has said from Gregg on that a defendant should receive individualized consideration, that there should be allowances made for the jury to impose mercy in a particular case, that what is important is that an individual's character and background should be viewed by the jury. And that was done in this case. It was done by the certification judge before the individual was certified to stand trial as an adult. It was viewed at the time the jury made the decision. They found the existence of an aggravating circumstance. He was free to introduce evidence of any mitigating circumstance. He received an instruction that the youthfulness of the defender had been offered as evidence of mitigating circumstances. And we think that this individual defendant, his attorney argued in closing argument in the second stage that age was a consideration. In their brief, they pointed out, took one statement by the prosecutor out of context, but the record shows that, particularly on page 760, the prosecutor specifically told the jury that in the second stage of the trial, that age is a relevant mitigating circumstance, a comment he made at least two times during the voir dire examination. So we think that as long as the jury, and the jury has traditionally been held to be that link to involving standards of decency in the community, and Justice Stevens in his dissent in Spisanio said as much. In this particular case, 12 people heard all this evidence and made the decision that the death penalty should be imposed, and we think it was appropriate. It has been observed that chronological age is an inherently poor criterion by which to draw the line with regard to criminal responsibility. We've noted in our brief that all federal and state courts have considered the issue have rejected the proposition that there is one uniform age that the Constitution sets as that below which a state can never go in imposing the death sentence. In fact, the existence of certification, transfer, and waiver statutes in this country...
But you don't agree with that. It seems to me you're arguing two different lines. The argument you are now supporting says that there can't be any minimum age.
Well, I'm saying that there is a bottom somewhere.
All right.
I'm saying that...
By age,
there would be. But I'm saying that particularly with what they want, I mean, they want an age that would save the client in this particular case, and an age they say is 18, and there's any number of ages that could be selected, and there's any number of ages that have been selected by the different states. And we think that the state is the proper entity to decide what the minimum age should be, is all I'm saying.
Above 10, anyway.
Yes. Yes, sir.
If you're arguing that we shouldn't set it lower than any legislature set it, I suppose, that's one thing to...
I'm saying if there was a case that came up where the legislature had set the age at 10 and a 10-year-old person was on death row, I think it would be appropriate under the cruel and unusual punishment clause.
You can argue statistics a million different ways, but is it correct? I think you said that there had been no actual execution carried out of a defendant who was 15 or younger at the time of the crime, since 1948, something like that?
In 1948, there was a 16-year-old that was executed in this country. As far as the actual 15-year-old, further back than that, I'm not sure. I think it's important to point out that this individual is 1.5 months prior to his 16th birthday.
I understand, but it wouldn't be a different case if it was 15 and a half instead of 15 years.
No, we don't think so. We think that's why...
But I was just wondering, to what extent, are there statistics in these exhibits and all about juveniles and so forth, do we know how many, say, since the turn of the century, how many defendants who were under 16 at the time of the offense have actually been executed in the whole, say, the last 100 years?
I am unable at this time to recall what that figure would be, Your Honor.
Is it more than a handful, do you know?
I, in all honesty, I cannot remember.
I couldn't figure it out either.
Are there any?
I'm unable at this time to recall what that figure was, Your Honor. I'm sorry. Obviously, it's something that... I can't remember. It's just... Obviously, we want to be very careful with this, and I am glad that I am not coming here saying that there have been hundreds and hundreds of young persons who have been executed, therefore this is constitutional. I think it's good that in this country that the individual senators and the individual legislatures have been careful with regard to this decision. All I'm saying, if in particular cases involving an individual like the petitioner in this case, like Christopher Berger, like Kevin Stanford, like individuals like that, for committing a particularly vicious crime, that if the particular act has been reviewed, as it was in this particular case, by a certification judge and then by the jury, that the state should be free to impose the death penalty.
One of the reasons I'm trying to explore this is you expressed, I think, very appropriately, the concern about sending the wrong message to potential offenders who are under 16. Of course, if you assume that they are very brilliant and knowledgeable about what's happened in the criminal justice system in the last century, I don't suppose it's much more of a deterrent to have one out of one every 50 years than to have none at all.
Well, as I've stated, we've only had 95 executions in this country since 1967, which means it's very rare and frequent, but I don't think that should be the basis for abolishing the death penalty in this country. I mean, the states have tried to impose the death penalty.
No, but there's a lot of difference between 95 in 3 or 4 years and none in 100 years.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I said there's a lot of difference between 95 in 5 or 6 years, whatever it is, and only one or two in a century.
Well, there's got to be a bottom somewhere. At some point, there's going to be a...
But I'm just focusing on the deterrence argument at this point.
Yes. I think in this day... I mean, particularly the petitioner in this case, this was a streetwise individual. He's had before the murder, he had 7 contacts with law enforcement officials. This is an individual who was aware of what might happen to him with regard to the fact that he was going to be picked up by law enforcement.
Also, I suppose if you talk about the particulars, there were several people involved in the killing here, were there not?
Yes, and I know that particularly Justice Blackmun has been concerned, like his dissent in the Berger case, he was concerned about the possibility that there might be domination by other individuals. In this particular case, this individual was tried separately. There was nothing like there was in the Berger case that would prevent his attorney from presenting mitigating circumstances with regard to this case. There's not one word in the record that suggests that this individual acted under the domination of anybody else. He certainly had enough family members that testified that could have testified if Mr. Thompson at one point had said that
his family was involved in the crime, weren't they?
Well, there was one half-brother that was, but he made statements to a number of family, or at least close friends, and to family members. There were certainly plenty of family members around that could have testified that he made the comment that he did this because he was afraid of Tony Mann or because they made him do it. The record is clear in this case that this individual acted of his own free will and volition in this particular case, and there's no inference whatsoever that he was dominated by any of these other individuals. We, as I've noted, we think that it's important that the states, even states that have set a minimum age for the imposition of the death sentence, cannot agree on what that minimum age should be. And it was unclear until the oral argument what the petitioner himself thinks the minimum age should be. We believe that common sense tells us that if asked what the minimum age for the imposition of the death penalty should be, most people would say that it depends on the individual facts of the case, including the seriousness of the crime and what that individual defendant is really like. We contend that the objective factors in this case do not support the petitioner's position. As we've noted, all state Supreme Courts that have ruled on this issue have rejected the contention that age alone should bar imposition of the death sentence. 19 states, as I've noted, permit the execution of a person who was under the age of 16 at the time of the murder. By my count, there are presently 38 persons on death row in this country who were under the age of 18 at the time of the commission of the crime. And these were people who were sentenced by judges and juries in 14 different states. In 1 year period of time from 1985 until 1986, 3 persons who were 17 at the time of the commission of the murder were executed. We contend that there is no unambiguous trend in this country with regard to the raising or lowering of the age for the death sentence. As I previously mentioned, Congress in 1984 lowered the age for transfer for violent crimes from 16 to 15, which, in my view, in response to Justice Scalia's question, that under the Federal Air Piracy Act, which was mentioned by this court in the McCleskey case, a 15-year-old person could now, if he's properly transferred pursuant to the certification transfer statutes, could receive the death penalty if the procedure is adequate. Therefore, the general public sentiment and the objective factors that would justify the abolition of the death penalty for young murderers is not present. We think that the crime itself, of course, is relevant in proportionality principles. One who reads the facts of many of these cases cannot help but think that individual states and individual juries are justified in imposing the death sentence in those cases. In the present case, the petitioner was convicted and sentenced because of his direct role in a calculated savage murder. He was certified to stand trial as an adult after two hearings, one where the certifying judge determined prosecutive merit, and another where the judge weighed six factors under our certification statute. And I might note that our certification statute is very similar to the federal transfer statute, Title 18, Section 5032. These factors included, first, the willful nature of the act, whether the crime involved an act against the person. Another consideration made by the certifying judge was the sophistication and maturity of the petitioner and his capability of distinguishing right from wrong, as determined by his psychological evaluation, his home, his environmental situation, his emotional attitude and pattern of living, and finally, the record and past history and the prospects for rehabilitation.
Lee, how many federal offenses carry the death penalty?
I think that's the only one, Your Honor, is the Federal Air Piracy Act. I think that's the only one that I know of. We note that the petitioner
in this... What about murder and rape?
Excuse me?
Murder and rape are federal charges.
Well, I don't know if presently, at the present time, that that's a possible punishment for... is possible under federal law for the receipt of the death sentence.
Treason?
But I think right now that air piracy is the only one, Your Honor. It was mentioned specifically by this court in a footnote in the McCleskey case, and I don't know of any others. I might note that the petitioner in his brief made note of the fact that there should be an attempt for rehabilitation. We contend that the petitioner in this case was the beneficiary of a number of rehabilitative efforts in this case. Over the years, he received counseling. He received he had a tour at a home outside of in Oklahoma City. He received probationary services. He had a test. He had testing done on him 6 months before the murder, and none of these seemed to make any difference. A fact revealed to him, a fact testified by the probation officer at the time he was certified. I want to note before I close that in their brief, the petitioner mentioned the fact that the Tenth Circuit has said that our aggravating circumstance, especially heinous, atrocious, or cruel, has been found by the Tenth Circuit to be overbroad. I want to point out that the aggravating circumstance that was mentioned in the reply brief, it wasn't mentioned until that time, the instruction in this particular case is not the same instruction that was used, which is the subject of the Cartwright versus Maynard case. In this particular case, the jury was instructed that the aggravating circumstances, heinous, atrocious, or cruel, the murder must be preceded by torture or serious physical injury. So we think that the instruction in this case is different than the one out of the Tenth Circuit, which is mentioned in the reply brief, in that it sufficiently narrows the class of people that are subject to the death sentence. Does the Court have further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Mr. Tepper, you have 5 minutes remaining.
Thank you. First, if I may focus on the deterrence question. We're talking about a risk of a death sentence that is already extremely low. We are also talking about a situation in which we've got individuals who are impulsive, they're not necessarily calculating, sophisticated individuals. To believe in the deterrent effect when the risk is so small, even with the sophisticated and the calculating, is difficult enough. But for the individuals of the nature who are being sentenced to death...
Every person under 18 is sophisticated and calculating.
No, Your Honor, that is not what I meant to say. What I meant to say is they are part of a class that share characteristics of immaturity, and they are particularly vulnerable to those personality characteristics. What I'm trying to say is even for the sophisticated individual, the risk is not great. The deterrent effect even for them might be extremely minimal. But for these individuals who are the ones receiving the death sentence, it is extremely difficult to believe that deterrence plays any meaningful role in the kinds of thought processes that led to these crimes. Certification has been discussed, and perhaps my answers were garbled before, so I wanted to focus on that. We do not challenge the certification of Wayne Thompson before this court. The certification process is designed to assess capacity for rehabilitation within the Oklahoma system, and it refers as much to the Oklahoma system as it does to the individual. But more to the point, it does not focus on the question of moral culpability for purposes of the death penalty. It's designed to avoid a prospect that I think everyone in this room would find very difficult to accept, the prospect of a manifestly unfair short incarceration period for a serious offense. If Wayne Thompson had not been certified to stand trial as if he were an adult, he would have been under the rehabilitation system for something less than 3 years, a plainly short time. The question of certification, as decided by the Oklahoma trial courts, does not go to the question of the justice of the death penalty, and it does not negate the need for some clear focus by the sentencing authority on the propriety of the death sentencing process. It does not even depend on the question of maturity.
Do you count the number of states who authorize the death penalty for people under 15? Do you count them the same as your opponent?
Well, my understanding, it's 18, Your Honor. 18 jurisdictions, 18 of 36, retain the possibility of executing someone below the age of 16. 17 of those are by express statute.
Right.
One
All
of
right.
those...
Anyway, again, so you're only a part, at least, no more than one.
That's right.
All
that's right.
right.
The question of rehabilitation has been raised. We do suggest it is appropriate for the jury to make a judgment about rehabilitation. With respect to Wayne Thompson, I would point out that the jury was asked by the prosecutor to find that this individual would commit acts of violence in the future, and they refused to so find. That's a clear indication that this question of rehabilitation was not brought home to them as being of a primary importance or focus for purposes of assessing the death sentence. Moreover, the state's description of the rehabilitation efforts for Wayne Thompson, while accurate to a degree, are somewhat exaggerated. Despite the seriousness of previous incidents involving law enforcement, Wayne Thompson was never institutionalized. He was referred to a private church home for something like a month. He did receive some counseling both at school and elsewhere, but there was never any effort, despite the seriousness of these offenses, to institutionalize him in the juvenile justice system. Given that fact, I think it's fair to say that the rehabilitative potential of Wayne Thompson is up in the air. It is uncertain and not at all clear that the jury did not make the right decision when it refused to find a propensity for future violence in the past and in the future. One last point. Counsel for the state has conceded that there's a bottom somewhere. I suggest that if one is going to make a careful assessment of where that bottom is, the only concept that's meaningful in the law is the concept of non-adulthood. To draw a line right in the middle of the class of non-adults, right in the middle of the class who share these characteristics of inexperience, immaturity, right in the middle of this class of individuals who are so difficult to judge at age 15 or 13 or 14, makes no sense whatever. Non-adulthood should be the concept. The tradition of criminal jurisprudence and American jurisprudence is that these non-adults ought to be treated differently, judged more fairly. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Tepker. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument next.